You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Our cases have been researched using open source and archive materials. It deals with true crimes and real people. Some parts are graphic in nature, and listener discretion is advised. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. In the small town of Ancaster, Ontario, things were often quiet. Children played outside, neighborhoods held barbecues. Residents felt comfortable enough to leave their doors unlocked and were optimistic about their bright city. That was until a heinous crime uncovered what was lurking in the shadows. When a loving husband and father went missing after meeting two strangers, residents of Ancaster began to think twice about who they invited into their homes. In May of 2012, the disappearance of Tim Bosma and the subsequent investigation proved that appearances can be deceiving. Tim Bosma was a building contractor from Hamilton who lived for his family. A church-going man, Tim was known for his kindness and integrity. He met the beautiful Charlene Veenstra on eHarmony, and they clicked immediately. They had a common background. Both came from large, Dutch, church-going families. In 2012, Tim and Charlene Bosma were happily married and had a 2-year-old daughter and a Great Dane puppy. With one child quickly growing up, Bosma and Charlene were trying for a second, but it wasn't happening for them. Completing their family was a dream they were not ready to give up on. Multiple visits to a fertility clinic every month was not a cheap exercise. But if that meant giving a sibling to their daughter, they were happy to pay. The Bosmas were positive that good news of a second child was imminent, and they set out to get ready. They were prepared to make big changes. The plan was for them to sell their Ancaster home and move to a more affordable town nearby. Then Charlene could stay home and raise their family. Tim's most prized possession was a black 2007 Dodge Ram. Unfortunately, they could not keep up with the hefty monthly cost. With a home and a growing family, their priorities were changing anyway, and Tim and Charlene decided that instead of continuing to struggle with the maintenance, they'd get rid of it. For months, Tim and Charlene tried to sell the truck, but didn't receive any offers. While researching ways in which they could find someone to take the truck off of their hands, Charlene came across an up-and-coming online site, Kijiji. Kijiji was garage sales made easy. You could take household items you no longer needed, list them on the site, and have someone come pick them up and pay you in cash. For a new family needing quick money, Kijiji seemed like the perfect solution. Charlene listed the truck with hopes that it would catch someone's eye. Their 4x4 Dodge Ram, with 170,000 kilometers on the clock, was listed for $24,000 Canadian dollars. Not a bad price for a truck that age. The brakes were brand new, and the interior was in good shape, so Tim agreed that someone would probably jump on that opportunity. On Monday night, the 6th of May, 2013, 32-year-old Tim Bosma was having a usual night at home, spending time with his family, doing chores, and preparing for the next day's work. He was also waiting for a potential buyer to come and have a look at their truck. A couple of days before, someone had reached out after seeing the ad in Kijiji. Tim promptly replied when a man said that he was keen to see the car and wanted to take it for a test drive. They agreed to meet, but the person never showed up. Tim gave it a few days, but didn't want to lose the deal, so he called the person and asked if he was still interested. And he was glad that he did, because they were scheduled. Tim was convinced the truck was going to sell that Monday after the test drive. He used the weekend to prepare the truck, cleaning both the interior and the exterior. It was spotless. When 7 p.m. Monday night rolled by, there was no sign of the prospective buyer. Tim and Charlene were a bit anxious to make a sale, but at the same time, Didn't want to be too pushy. When the buyer hadn't shown up by 8:30, Tim called and confirmed his address. The man confirmed that he was on his way. Tim had a bad feeling about the deal. Still, he shrugged it off. At 9 p.m., Tim and Charlene put their toddler daughter to bed. Unsure of if the potential buyers would really show up, Charlene and the basement tenant, Wayne DeBoer, headed out to the garage for a cigarette before calling it a night. A few minutes later, they finally heard voices traveling up the gravel driveway. They were there. Charlene saw two figures walking towards the house. One of them was on a cell phone. She assumed he was talking to Tim to inform him of their arrival. As they came closer, Charlene and Wayne greeted the men. They were charming and friendly, and well-dressed. Tim came out to meet them too, and they had a bit of a chinwag. The men thought the Bozema's house was nice, and were eager to see the Dodge Ram. Tim asked if they wanted to pull their car into the drive, as it was a bit of a walk to the road. They explained that they were dropped off by a friend who would pick them up again later. In a small area like Ancaster, the only way to get around was by car. Charlene thought to herself that it was strange that the men had caught a lift, but seeing as they were looking to buy a car, it made sense. They clearly needed one. The taller of the two men was confident and talkative, quite sociable really. The shorter guy, slumping in his red hoodie, appeared to be a bit sketchy, and he didn't contribute much to the conversation. The three men had a good look at the truck as Tim explained its journey and how it ran, including all of its features. The buyers were interested, but of course, they needed a test drive to seal the deal. Earlier that evening, Tim had asked Charlene if she thought he should go with him. She joked and said, "Yes, you should, because we want the truck to come back." So when it was time to take the truck for a spin around the neighborhood, Tim hopped in the passenger seat. The tall man drove, and his friend in the hoodie sat in the back. "I'll be right back," Tim said to Charlene with a smile, hopeful that the sale would pan out. Charlene and Wayne watched the truck pull away and waited. Within a few minutes, the truck had not returned, which made Charlene feel uneasy. Surely they would not have gone farther than a couple of blocks. Wayne even made a joke about maybe never seeing him again. Little did he know, his comment would come back to haunt them all. By 11 p.m., Tim had not returned. Charlene felt a sense of panic, because if there had been a problem, she knew Tim would have called her to let her know. He never disappeared on her, and he always took her calls. But he wasn't responding to her texts when she called, and went straight to his voicemail. She knew Tim charged his phone when he came home after work. It would not have run out of charge. 10 o'clock came and went, and by 11, they were still not back. Worried, Wayne and Charlene took another vehicle to do a quick search to see if the men had maybe stopped somewhere. Maybe they were grabbing a bite to eat and didn't get a chance to let Charlene know. The two of them drove around parking lots and streets nearby, but had no luck. They found no sign of the car or of Tim, and Charlene was beside herself. However, she was hesitant to call the police at first. Tim was a grown man who could handle himself, and she didn't want to cause a drama just because he took a bit longer than she expected. Instead, she waited, frantically checking her cell phone to see if he had reached out to her yet. She had a feeling that something was terribly wrong. When she couldn't stand it any longer, she called the police. By the next morning, the news of Tim's disappearance had spread through the town of Ancaster. People who knew Tim, his family, friends, and the church community, were immediately alarmed. The Bozema Army, as they called themselves, launched a spirited search effort. However, even as Charlene reported him missing and explained the suspicious circumstances to the police, the investigation did not kick off right away. Originally, police had released only a vague missing persons press release, mentioning no word about the test drive in the truck or the other two men involved that evening. On May the 9th, 3 days after last seeing Tim, the Bozema family gathered at police headquarters in Hamilton, Ontario, for a press conference. Charlene made a desperate plea for her husband's safe return, begging anybody with information to come forward, and for Tim to return home safe if he was watching. She said, It was just a truck, a stupid truck. You do not need him. But I do. Our daughter needs her daddy. The next day, police announced that they had located Tim's cell phone in an industrial area. At this point, they released updated descriptions of the men last seen with Tim Bosma. The men were identified as Dylan Millard and Mark Smitch. Kijiji also released a statement regarding Tim Bosma's disappearance, warning others about the dangers associated with online sales. On the Saturday, after Tim's disappearance, police arrested Dylan Millard for forcible confinement and robbery of over $5,000. The next day, police located Tim's Dodge Ram in Kleinburg, north of Toronto. It was parked on the property of Madeline Millard, Dylan's mother. There was no sign of Tim, however, and the Bosma family was still holding out in hope that he was alive somewhere. They kept the story going in the media, making pleas for Tim's return, hoping against hope that he would soon be returned to them. But sadly, this was not how it played out. On May the 14th, the police chief of Hamilton announced that they had found what they believed to be Tim Bosma's remains. Investigators theorized that Tim was likely targeted and died soon after his disappearance. Details about his death would come to light later in the investigation. With the investigation running at full speed, the Bosma family came to terms with their loss. A memorial service for Tim was held on the 22nd of May. His wife Charlene spoke bravely and paid her respects to her loving husband and the father of their 2-year-old daughter. This unthinkable loss affected Bosma's family greatly. They vowed to support the police throughout the investigation and were determined to get justice for their beloved Tim. On the same day as Tim's memorial, the second suspect, Mark Smitch, was arrested and charged with first-degree murder. In the days that followed Smitch's arrest, the Crown Prosecution was eager to learn the details of how and why Tim died after he got in that car with Millard and Smitch. These three men were the only people who knew what happened. The unfortunate truth is that only two are here to tell it. Two who would soon turn on each other. But who were the men police had in custody? Dylan Millard and Mark Smitch met in 2006 and had found themselves on the wrong side of the law before. Where Millard came from a wealthy family, Smitch had made some money dealing drugs. Dylan Millard also dealt drugs on the side, but he never needed the money. He was heir to an aviation dynasty. Millard Air was founded by his grandfather. Born to Wayne and Madeline Millard on the 30th of August, 1985, Dylan had a life of privilege in his hometown of Toronto. The young Millard made history in 1999, when, at the age of 14, he was the youngest pilot to complete a solo flight of both a helicopter and an airplane on one day. His parents divorced when Dylan was a teenager. Once a bright-eyed, clean-cut trust fund tween, Dylan became a troubled youth. With all the opportunities in the world, Millard opted to go along a shady path instead. He hosted parties with hundreds of guests. Drugs and alcohol flowed freely, and Millard always pushed the limits of consumption. At 27, he was a college dropout who had business ventures on the go and multiple properties within his reach. He owned two homes in Toronto, a 55,000-square-foot hangar at an international airport, classic cars, airplanes, helicopters, and had money in every nook and cranny. His lifestyle was every bit the playboy life, with vacations on a whim and hanging out at bars every weekend. He enjoyed entertaining at his home in Etobicoke, hosting one wild pool party after another. Dylan Millard had been talking about getting a pickup truck since 2011, when he took a road trip to Mexico with his friends. The kick was the pickup truck he owned at the time was not diesel. Regularly fueled cars were much more expensive to run, and an out-of-country road trip was expensive in his current vehicle. He wanted to take his friends on another road trip, but this time he was going to do so in a diesel truck. Sadly, his father Wayne committed suicide in November 2012. Just after completing construction on a $3 million hangar, where he was going to start a business in aviation, maintenance, and repair. Kind of like a mechanic workshop for planes, if you will. Dylan Millard decided to let his father's venture die with him and took possession of the hangar. But he would not use it for business. It was the perfect place where he could store things he picked up on his missions. When talk of the next trip started heating up, Millard felt he had a deadline looming on the horizon. He was determined to source the right vehicle, but not to buy. He was going to steal one. Millard began looking for listings online with the help of Mark Smitch. To his friends, it seemed as if stealing a car was just one of the errands in between his others. This would not be his first theft. He had stolen machinery as large as a Bobcat construction vehicle before. Stealing a pickup truck from an unsuspecting seller was no big deal for the likes of Millard. 2 days before Tim Bosma's abduction, Millard showed his roommate, Andrew Michalski, a photo on the site called Kijiji. Millard had found a truck listed for a reasonable price. He proposed it to his roommate, asking if he should steal it. Michalski, however, told Millard he didn't need to steal a truck. He knew he had stolen stuff before, but Millard really had no reason. Being that Millard could easily afford one, sparing his pennies was the least of his problems. Why not go out and buy a brand new diesel truck? According to Michalski, the only reason Millard had for wanting to steal a truck was for the thrill. It was the adrenaline rush he was looking for. Millard's best friend Mark Smitch, on the other hand, did not have the same motivation. He was a drug-dealing high school dropout with dreams of making it as a rap artist. He was not someone who stood out in a crowd, a slight and scrawny guy. Smitch spent his days smoking pot and drinking beer. His main source of income was helping Millard on his missions. When Smitch first heard about the diesel truck mission, he was not interested. He didn't want a truck. In fact, Smitch didn't even have a driver's license. Other than helping out his buddy, this mission really meant nothing to him. Dylan Millard felt that the good-as-new truck listed on Kijiji looked perfect. So he reached out to the seller and arranged to view it, and if he liked it, he would pay in cash. On the evening of the scheduled test drive, Millard and Smitch made their way to Ancaster. Millard sent his girlfriend a message to say that he was on his way to a mission, and that he'd be done in 2 hours if it didn't pan out. If they managed to succeed, however, he'd let her know, as he would not make it home. Millard and Smitch headed down the highway and pulled off to park their dark blue GMC Yukon on the side of Book Road, around the corner from the Bosma residence. It was already dark when they walked up the drive on that cool, dry, and breezy May evening. Millard wore a long-sleeved shirt and jeans, and Smitch wore a baggy red hoodie, pulled up way over his head. As they headed up the driveway, Millard gave Tim Bosma a call to let them know they had arrived. He was using a burner phone that he purchased under a fake name, specifically for this mission. As they paced up the driveway, they could hear voices carrying in the hollow air. Tim came out to greet them before they took a quick look at the car before jumping in for a test run. And Tim never made it back again. Dylan Millard owned multiple properties across the Toronto and Hamilton areas, and police visited each one, hoping to smoke Mark Smitch out of hiding. Along the way, on a large piece of land in Ayr, Ontario, police found an industrial-sized incinerator. It yielded enough evidence so they could charge Millard with first-degree murder. The chase was on to find the second suspect in the case, Millard's accomplice, Mark Smitch. Police believed that Millard and Smitch used two vehicles that evening, Tim Bosma's Ram and Millard's Yukon. At 11:30, Millard sent his girlfriend Christina an update, letting her know the mission was a success and that he was going to be out all night. By this time, Bosma was already dead. Millard and Smitch made their way to Waterloo after stopping at Millard's farm to pick up the Eliminator, a $15,000 incinerator that he had purchased a year before. Surveillance footage inside the Millard hangar caught two men strolling around at 1:33 a.m., with a dog not far behind. This dog was later identified to be Millard's rescue puppy from one of his road trips. The camera catches a distant, tiny flame in the corner, likely from the incinerator. After they burned the victim's body, Smitch stripped and washed him in Charlene's truck, hosing the blood off of the seats, seatbelts, and carpet. Some items were also thrown into the incinerator to be burnt along with their victim's body. By this point, Smitch's girlfriend, Marlena Meneses, was also trying to get a hold of him, frantic that he had been gone for so long, annoyed that he had not given her a heads up. She was also informed about the plan to steal the truck, and she was worried at this point that something had gone wrong. CCTV footage at Meneses' apartment building in Oakville, Ontario, shows Smitch and Millard entering the lobby of her building on Tuesday morning. Smitch jumps out to open the door for her, and the three of them looked excited, like they were celebrating something. Earlier that morning, Millard also sent a text message to Millard Air staff, who worked at the hangar, telling them not to come into work, because of office politics. The men used the opportunity to get rid of any evidence before police beat them to it. But they didn't do a very good job. When staff returned to work on Wednesday morning, Bozma's truck was parked inside the hangar on a green tarp. A man by the name of Art Jennings showed up to work and saw the truck. He asked one of his colleagues about it. This colleague, Shane Schlattman, mentioned that this belonged to Millard and that it was better not to ask any questions, because Millard's business was simply Millard's business. Jennings had heard about the Bozma story on the news, and he understood that the police were looking for a stolen Dodge Ram, just like the one in the hangar. Jennings could not shake that gut feeling inside of him. Could it be the truck the police were looking for? The next day, Jennings waited for Millard to leave the hangar and then snuck photos of the truck on his cell phone. In case anything was to come of this, he wanted proof to help the investigation rather than get stuck on the wrong side of it. Millard showed up and loaded the Dodge into a trailer and drove to his mother's home 40 minutes away. He used his own red Dodge Ram to tow the trailer, leaving his GMC Yukon at the hangar in Hamilton. So after a quick turnaround, he went back to retrieve his car. Once they made it to Waterloo, they switched cars, leaving the red truck behind, and hopped into the Yukon. Millard then took his Yukon to his farm, where in the pitch black of the country night, they hauled the incinerator out of his barn, towing it down the laneway of his property to hide it. After a long night of driving, their last stop was at 4 a.m., when they headed over to a friend, Matt Hangerman's house, in Etobicoke. Millard dropped the toolbox off and told Hangerman he needed to hold onto it for a few days. Then Millard headed home. A few hours later, Millard was surprised to meet police at his hangar at 7 a.m. Police had received a tip-off from a Toronto man by the name of Igor Timenenko. Timenenko had informed police that the day before Tim Bozma's disappearance, he had also taken two strange men on a test drive. Timenenko described the two men. One was tall, the other one shorter. The tall one had a satchel with him and did most of the talking. Timenenko was a retired Israeli soldier, a large, muscular man. Millard and Smitch probably decided to pull the plug on their mission, knowing that they were up against someone who was physically stronger than the two of them combined. That morning, at the Hamilton hangar, when Millard arrived, police officers noticed a significant detail. He was wearing a satchel. The second identifier that gave police the correct identification was a tattoo on Millard that wrote Ambition. Investigators asked Millard if they could have a look around, as they received a tip into a missing person investigation. He nervously agreed and kept a keen eye on them. After they left, the police radioed in to have Millard put under surveillance. They knew they had their man, but they needed more evidence before they could make an arrest. As soon as Millard was alone, he called Smitch and warned him that the cops were closing in on them. Millard decided to get out of town for a couple of days to lay low. While driving on Cawthra Road in Mississauga around 7:30 that evening, Millard was boxed in by police cars. He was asked to get out of the car, and an officer read him his rights. Inside of Millard's Yukon truck, they found the keys to Tim Bozma's Dodge Ram dangling on Millard's keyring. When Millard was arrested, Smitch realized that he would be next. He knew what had to be done. He had to collect the toolbox from Matt Hangerman. But he was concerned police were following him, so he asked a friend to run the errand for him. This was arguably the most vital piece of evidence. Inside the toolbox was the murder weapon, a gun that they used to shoot Tim Bozma, only minutes after pulling out of his driveway. As the investigation continued, police headed over to Ayr, Ontario, where the 10-foot-tall incinerator was discovered by a dirt biker riding near Millard's property. Forensic investigators discovered a bone inside, and a leading forensic anthropologist was called to examine the contents of the incinerator. The findings are gruesome. Charred human bones turned out to be that of Tim Bosma. The trial began on February the 1st, 2016. Both Millard and Smitch were on trial for first-degree murder. Millard's girlfriend, Christina Nudga, was also on trial for accessory to murder. There were crowds of people waiting outside the courtroom each morning, hoping to catch a glimpse of what happened inside, and hoping for justice for this father and husband. If Tim Bosma could be a target, anyone could. Physical evidence from the Bosma's family truck was the first evidence at trial. The forensic examination found the car to be stripped of nearly everything. The seats had been taken out, and the carpets had been lifted. The front seats were found in the trailer Millard had taken to his mother's residence. The center console and cushioning had all been burned. There was a significant amount of gunshot residue inside of the truck. The highest concentrations were found in the front seat, both on the ceiling of the passenger side and driver's side. As we know, Tim was seated in the front passenger side when the car left his driveway that evening. In addition, there was a .380 gun cartridge casing found inside the truck, and the passenger side window had been shattered. This supported the theory that the shooter was inside the truck when he pulled the trigger. Forensic examiners also found blood evidence on the inside of the passenger side door, on the rear passenger armrest, inside the cup holder, and on the truck's undercarriage. An attempt had been made to clean it, but hidden particles remained. The blood was Tim Bosma's. The next piece of major evidence used in the trial was the incinerator found in Millard's farm. The eliminator contained pieces of both human and animal remains, likely to throw investigating officers off. All up, 58 bone fragments were found, as well as 2 complete bones and a single tooth. Of these fragments, 17 were identified as human. The anthropologist working on the incinerator concluded that the bones likely belonged to a man under the age of 40. Inside the incinerator, and last to be tested, were fragments of Tim's blood. It was clear that Tim was murdered inside of his own truck, and his remains were burned in the eliminator. The only question left at this point was who the killer was. Millard and Smitch were both in the car with him, but who fired the shot that killed the young father? And why? What motive did Millard or Smitch have to kill him? And did they have enough evidence to prove it? While Millard was on remand, he spent many months alone. During this time, he did not have much else to do but read books and write letters. Meanwhile, Millard's longtime girlfriend, Christina Nudga, was charged as an accessory after the fact. Police had enough reason to believe she was a bystander, based on communication between her and Millard on the night Tim was taken. While she was in custody, investigators obtained a warrant to search her belongings. Among them, Millard's incriminating letters, written from prison. Although they varied by content, some of them alluded to the upcoming trial, and Millard informed Nudga that she would have to be a witness. He playfully asked her to be a secret spy. The letters, written before her detainment, had information asking her to meet with various people to align a story that would help Millard get off on a not guilty charge to avoid further jail time. Also in the letters, Millard claimed that the murder was a robbery gone wrong. Smitch had ruined his plan when he shot Tim Bosma. Millard believed he should not be facing jail time because of something that Smitch did. Many of the letters had specific instructions to destroy after reading, which Nudga obviously ignored. In the letters, Millard instructed Nudga that she needed to do her best to keep Millard's old roommate, Andrew Michalski, out of the case. Michalski was the only one who knew the plan right from the beginning. Although he was not involved in the abduction, murder, and theft, Millard and Smitch shared the details of the planned mission before it took place. When police learned about Michalski's knowledge of the crime, they questioned him, and he gave his full cooperation. He provided them with a motive. Well, as close as they were going to get in establishing one. It was simple. Millard did it for the thrill. He did not need to steal a car, nor did he have to murder someone in order to do so. But once Millard had made up his mind up about a mission, he would not stop until it was done. During their search of Christina Nudga's bedroom, police found a digital recorder that Millard had taken from the airport and asked her to hang on to. The video footage on the tape inside the recorder was examined. It was proof that both Millard and Smitch were at the hangar on the night of the murder at around 1:30 a.m. At this time, Tim Bosma's remains were being incinerated by the Eliminator just outside the hangar doors. Close to 100 witnesses were called to testify, among them Charlene Bosma, and Millard and Smitch's girlfriends, Christina Nudga and Marlena Meneses. Meneses helped police to locate Smitch, which led to his arrest. The witnesses laid out the case, painting the picture of events in the months leading up to Tim Bosma's murder. Marlena Meneses told the court Millard often gave her the creeps. She claimed she was unaware of the murder and was not involved in the planning. She wanted to have a child with Mark Smitch and was heartbroken when she learned about what he had done. It was evident that Millard's girlfriend, Christina Nudga, knew more about the murder than Marlena Meneses. Nudga admitted to being with Millard when they drove the trailer containing Tim's car to Millard's mother's house. Her testimony did not hold much else information, and she was careful to hold her tongue and not admit to anything that would cause her boyfriend to be found guilty. Regardless of what she did or didn't know, Nudga would not be the one to put her boyfriend behind bars. The physical evidence sealed the case for the prosecution. Millard and Smitch drove out to the Bosma residence on that fateful evening, knowing exactly what the plan was. The gunshot residue and blood evidence found in Tim's truck confirmed that the truck was the murder scene and that Tim was the victim. Tim's keys in Millard's possession, and ultimately the bone fragments found in the Eliminator, proved that Millard and Smitch were the killers. On Friday, June the 17th, 2016, both Millard and Smitch were convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to mandatory life imprisonment. 3 years after the tragic death of her husband, Charlene Bosma finally got the justice she deserved, and she was able to see the men she referred to as the devils come to see their fate. Millard and Smitch decided that Bosma's life was worth stealing his truck. Millard and Smitch are both currently serving their life sentences and will not have a chance for parole. Charlene Bosma, with the support of Tim's family and friends, founded a charity called Tim's Tribute. The organization offers support to families of homicide victims. From counseling to financial support, they assist families through the harrowing aftermath of losing a loved one to murder. If you'd like to support Tim's Tribute, find a link in the show notes of today's episode. This murder for a thrill took place less than a decade ago, and it still haunts the citizens living in the area. Tim wanted to sell his car so he could be able to provide for his family, a family that now lives without a husband and father, because an aimless playboy was chasing a thrill. And this was not his first time. In the course of the investigation, police were able to link him to two additional murders, equal in heartless cruelty. Join us next time as we explore these cases in part two of Dylan Millard and Mark Smitch, Rich and Ruthless. If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. Also, visit and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/evidencelockerpodcast to see more about today's case. If you like our podcast, please subscribe on Apple Podcast or wherever you are listening right now. This was The Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.